Wow. Well, I told Andy on the way over here, I said, this is my favorite Christmas party. This is my favorite Christmas party because I look out at your faces and I know so many of your stories, and I get the prayer requests from Kathy when you send prayer requests to the prayer team. And so I just know your stories. I know the things that are going on. Leslie and Hannah and the whole team does too. But I look out and I see your faces, and to me, you guys are heroes. And I know you don't think of yourselves as heroes, but we see you as heroes, and we are so thankful for what you do day in and day out with these kids who come from hard places. So we are very thankful for you. And in our book, you are heroes. Andy and I are so excited about just talking to you for a few minutes. And before I hand the microphone over to him, or before I go leave this chair and go sit down there where I feel like I belong, I just want to share a couple of things with you that you may or may not be aware of already, but are just so excited to me. Our model of having each of our families surrounded by a community of care, and each family having their own respite family and their own support team, you know, this is the model that we're hoping to export, and we're hoping that there will be lots of churches that will be able to do this. And this model, what we're seeing, and the statistics that you saw on the screen earlier, shows that it is working in a couple of three different areas that I think are hard things in foster care. Number one is foster family retention. And our retention of foster families is super, super high. Our disruptions are super, super low, as Leslie shared earlier. And so those things just make this model great. And so you respite families, when you're being proactive and checking in with your foster families and making sure that they have what they need, and you're asking them to please put some other things on the calendar so that you can be supportive to them, and you're making meals, you're making this model work, and your voice is going to be heard on a national level. And for you foster families who've got the kids in your home, when you take advantage of your support system and your respite families, your voice is being heard beyond just your own community of care. And here's why I think this is so important. It's not because North Point Ministries needs another shining star ministry for the nation to look at and try to emulate. And it's not even because Fostering Together wants to be this shining, you know, ministry that for people to copy. The reason that I think this is so important is because I believe with all my heart that the church is the answer for foster children in this country. The church is the answer for foster children. You know, there just are not enough foster homes in this country to take care of the foster children. And I think the church is the answer to that. On any given day in the United States, there are around 400,000 foster children. The faces change, but the number stays about the same, around 400,000 foster children. And, you know, foster children are far more likely as adults to experience homelessness, to experience unemployment, and later to experience incarceration. Foster children are far more likely to have those things happen. Also, foster children are four times more likely to be victims of commercial sexual exploitation. Four times more likely. So this whole idea of foster children having a safe place to be and changing things for foster children is just huge. That's why I think this is so, so important. And, you know, when children are taken out of their homes, they're taken out usually of a tumultuous situation, they so desperately need a safe place to land. And as you know, so many kids who come into foster care and go back to where they went, they're far worse off than they were before they ever left their original home. And I think the church can change that. Most foster kids who come into care have never been in a two-parent home before. Most kids who come into foster care have had very few opportunities to sit around a dinner table with a family and have conversation and eat together. Most children who come into care have very few memories of being tucked into bed at night safely and know that they're not going to be interrupted in the middle of the night by some crazy adult. I mean, they're just, you know, these are the things that they come into care with, and the church can change that. Most children who come into foster care have never heard that they have a heavenly Father who loves them and who will never under any circumstances leave them. They've been left a lot, and the church can change that. So I believe that the church is the answer for foster children in this country. And that's what you are doing every single day. And your voice is going to be heard more and more and more on a national level because of the opportunities that we as a church have. And so I just want to challenge you and encourage you with that idea. Each of you is making an enormous difference. You are making a huge difference for the children that you're tucking in at night, but you are going to be making a bigger and bigger difference on a national level. We have the opportunity as a church to show kids a different picture of what their future can look like, and the church can do that. You guys can do that, and you are doing that. And I think that's the most exciting thing about foster care is our ability and our opportunity to cast some vision for their lives beyond what they've ever known before. And when they leave foster care, when they leave foster homes, they have a better picture of what their future can be like. So thank you, thank you, thank you for what you do day in and day out. It's much bigger than you even realize. That's why this is my favorite Christmas party.
Whew.
And I think, how many churches are there? You told me that one time. I should know that.
Churches.
Yeah, there are about 400,000 churches of all different denominations. And so Sandra's point is, and you hopefully you've heard us talk about this before, it's kind of easy. You know, if every evangelical church, somewhat conservative church took in two or three foster kids, you know, problem solved. And of course, obviously the distribution of churches and foster kids isn't the same, but in terms of the reach, it's something that could potentially be done. Even if every large church did just a pretty good job at trying to create foster care initiatives through their local church, this is something that the church could own. And we don't mean own, obviously, in a legal sense, but just the influence, it's amazing. Now, what I want to do is give you a single illustration to prove Sandra's point, because your experience is no bigger than your experience. And you hear statistics like that and you go, yeah, that's fine, but you need to come home with me this afternoon, because because those statistics don't help me in the middle of the night. They don't help me when people don't show up and the moms don't show up and the ride doesn't show up. And, you know, but the story is simply this. Fostering together actually exists. The reason we're doing this is because of a single couple, because of a single pair of foster parents who almost 40 years ago, heard about fostering, decided to take a chance, got trained, had all the same fears that all of us have, all the same concerns. They had, I think they had three children at the time. And so meanwhile, while they're trying to talk themselves into this and talk themselves out of this and go through all the training, and do we really want to do this, and do we really have to do CPR again? And then they also had this experience, I bet, why didn't somebody tell us this before we had our own kids? We'd be better parents. I mean, the training's amazing. It's like, now they're telling me this? You know, I'm a far better foster parent than I ever was, probably a real parent, because of the training. So they're going through all that. Meanwhile, there's a little kid named Rick who's living down in Techwood Homes with his mom, and she's having a tough time, like a lot of foster kids' mothers or fathers do. He's in and out of the home. He's having to drive her home from things at 14 years old. He told me the situation where he drove from Cobb County to downtown when he was 14 years old with his mom in the car. Meanwhile, so things aren't going well for him at all. And to skip through some of the details of his situation, eventually he ends up with an uncle. And he tells his uncle, I'm not going home. I just can't go home. I can't do this. And so through an interesting set of circumstances, this uncle gets him placed at the Baptist Children's Home, which was kind of the modern day version of an orphanage. Obviously, much better circumstance than what we think of when we think about a traditional orphanage. But that was what children's homes, that was the role they played in our culture for a long time. And in some parts of our country still do. And then eventually, this family was told about little Rick. And at this time, I think he was 15 years old. And they were challenged with the opportunity of bringing a teenage boy into their home. And they took a deep breath and said yes. So it was not without its bumps, and it's not without its difficult transitions. At one point, he left. I think when he was 16, he left. And then they missed him, and the offense that he had created in the home was such that they had every reason in the world to ask him to leave. And then they invited him back, and he came back. And when he told me his story, he said, as Sandra just shared, and as you have heard us say before, and as you'll hear us say every time we gather, because this is the thing that got us into this. He said, Andy, the thing that made the difference, because he'd been in a couple of other homes, he'd been in a children's home, he'd had a terrible personal home life. He said, the thing that I'll never forget it was the first time I saw a family gather, as Sandra said, around a table and have dinner together. It was the first time I had been in a relationship with a man who had a job, who came home every day from a job. He said, the other thing was they took me to church, and he said, I thought all Christians were rich. He said, because all of these Christians had cars. He said, every single Christian I met, their family had a car. He said, that really struck me as interesting. How are all these Christians so rich? What's the connection? And in his teenage mind, that was the connection. So these two things, his introduction to Jesus, his introduction to the idea of a God who loved him as demonstrated through a family that took him in, was a game changer for him. It was the thing that turned on the lights in his heart and his soul. So almost 40 years later, I'm standing in the East Auditorium, and we just purchased property to build Brownsbridge Community Church, where many of you attend. And so we did our fundraiser that Sunday morning, and I got up and asked for all this money, and it's a necessary evil. It's just part of my job. I don't love to do it, but it's important, and I love the local church, so we do it. And after the service, down the aisle comes a man, and he introduced himself to me, and his name is Rick. He's about my age. And he said, I want to be a part of this, and I would like to help, but I need to make a few phone calls before I can tell you how much I can give. I said, well, that's fine. And I don't usually stand down after the service, but on that particular Sunday, I did. So I'm talking to some other people, and I noticed that this Rick guy didn't leave. He was just standing like right over there on the phone. And then he walked over and handed me the largest check that anyone had ever handed me. And I was like, wow, that was quick. Who did you call on Sunday morning? Who do you call on Sunday morning to find out how much money weigh? So I decided, well, I should get to know this guy. I mean, I'm not that smart, but even I figured that out. And so, because I'd never met him before. And so I called him and we got together, and I really just said, want to say thank you. I mean, here's a guy I met for the first time that just gave us this big check to build Brownsbridge Church up and coming. And in having lunch with him, he told me his story, and this was his story. And I went home and I said, Sandra, you're not going to believe this. I said, I told her the story, and we knew very little about fostering. In fact, we almost knew nothing about fostering. And when he told me, he said, significant role part of my life, I just saw a snapshot. All I needed was a snapshot. And then as I grew up, I realized that something was possible. I saw what could be, and I saw what should be, and I never, ever forgot that. And I thought, that is what somehow I want my life to be, and somehow that's what I want to emulate. He said, I just needed a picture of what could be. So I introduced Rick to about 15 of our staff. We went over to his office, and I said, Rick, tell us your story, and tell us how we can help, and he had a heart, obviously, for foster care, and he had a heart for foster care happening through the local church, and he had some ideas of a model, and he was working with Faith Bridge. And when he told, his story to our staff, we looked at each other, and our tension was this. We are a very, very focused, very, very intentional organization. We are just all about creating churches that unchurched people love to attend. And foster care was a little bit of sideways energy. Foster care didn't really fit into the model. Foster care wasn't something we felt like was replicable, foster care. But all of us left that time with Rick feeling like, you know what? Whether this fits our model or not, whether this makes sense in terms of our ministry strategy or not, whether it seems a little bit of sideways energy, a little bit unfocused or not, this is something we can do. And this is something we should do, because foster children are an unreached, invisible part of our community. So we got busy, and so Fostering Together was born. And so today, when we think about the however many hundred kids have come through the system in these 4 years that we've been doing this, and just the kids that have come through this year, the number of adoptions maybe you saw on the screen, some adoptions are in process right now with some of you. All of that is because of a single couple about 30-something years ago who decided to take a chance and do exactly what you did. So all of that to say, you have no idea, and I have no idea what hangs in the balance of our decision to engage in Fostering Together. And they all won't be success stories. You already know that. You knew that going in. Let's face it, the training, part of the training is to scare the heck out of you so that, it just kind of thins out the ranks pretty quick. I mean, if you're sitting in this room and you finish the training, and if you're continuing to do the continuing ed, which Sandra and I struggle to do, because here it comes again. I'm thinking, I already know how to do CPR. Do I have to go to another CPR class? Yes, I have to go to another CPR class. The fact that you're sitting here, you know the struggles. But as we think about the influence that we're beginning to have, not only on the kids in our communities, not only on the churches in our country, But the fact that we're here because of the influence of a single foster, of a single family who decided to foster a teenage boy, that age group and that profile that is maybe the scariest profile to bring into our home. It just goes to show that we, again, have no idea what our potential is and what God may do through your faithfulness. And as you just do the little thing you know to do, and eventually they're grown, and eventually they're gone, or eventually they age out, or eventually they go back to their family of origin, or eventually whatever happens, and you have no idea, did it do any good? Did it work? You know, is there anything to show for this? The point in all that is you have no idea, but this is an extraordinarily rich, rich, rich ministry. In fact, what I wrote in my notes is I think that that fostering is actually, and this isn't to discount anything else we do as a church, but it is actually the most significant kind of ministry that we can do as a church. And here's why I say that. And I've been in ministry a long time, obviously. That generally speaking, church ministry is preventative ministry. And nonprofit organizations are generally intervention ministry. By intervention, I mean you have homeless shelters, you have people collecting food for people who are starving, you have people who, you know, give money or provide money for children at risk. They are intervention. They go into difficult times, difficult circumstances. Churches are generally preventative. You can't measure it. We don't know how many kids, you know, aren't on the street because of what we do with middle school kids and elementary school kids. We don't know how many divorces were prevented. But, you know, church ministry is generally preventative. We're trying to keep people from dropping below a certain line in terms of behavior, faith, believe, the way they treat people, all that sort of stuff. Foster care is the perfect storm in a positive way of bringing together both prevention and intervention. It's intervention, obviously, because kids are yanked out of their homes, and next thing they know, they're in your home. So you are part of intervention. But it's prevention, because they're not simply given food and shelter. If they're placed in your home, if they're placed in our home, if they're placed in Christian homes, it is preventative because potentially it has the potential to prevent them from further bad decisions and perhaps prevent them from carrying on into the next generation the habits and the things that they've seen in their family of origin. It really is probably the best and most significant ministry that we do. And I really, really believe that. That means it will never be huge, but it will always be significant. It will never make sense financially, but we're going to fund it anyway. It means that there aren't going to be maybe as many positive stories as there are heartbreaking stories, but that's just the nature of ministry. So I really do think, even though initially this seemed like a little bit of sideways energy, a little bit off focus of what we do in terms of creating churches, I really believe that there is not a more significant ministry that we do, which means, from my perspective as your pastor and as a church planner of all the things I've seen, there isn't a more important thing that we do as a church, because it is both intervention, which we love intervention ministries, we all give to those, and it is preventative. Because who knows what you're preventing for a child or for a group of kids when we think about their future. It's not measurable, as I wrote down, but it is extraordinarily meaningful. And as a leader, I like things we can measure, and I like things that grow, and I like things that multiply. This is not that, but it is extraordinarily meaningful. And the multiplication factor of foster care will be one of those things that we won't really be able to measure for 10 or 15, or in Rick's case, almost 30 years. But I believe with all my heart, there will be more and more of those kinds of stories that come from our families. The other thing, and this kind of leads us into our time of communion, and if you would, real quickly, on your table, we have placed some communion elements, and if you would, maybe somebody who feels like a deacon, pass those out at your table real quick. Sandra reached for our first time she's acted as a deacon. That's great. If you could pass those out. And when Leslie said we're going to take communion, she didn't tell me why, and so I just came up with what I thought would be a good reason. Then when I got here today, she said, "Do you know why we're doing communion together?" I said, "Well, I think it's a great idea, but what did you have in mind?" And here's what she said. She said, "Because communion is always taken within the context of a community, and you within our large organization are a community of people, that you have far more in common with each other than perhaps you do with some people you sit next to in church or serve next to in Upstreet or Womboland or other places that you potentially serve. You have more in common with the people you're sitting with today perhaps than you do even some people you live close to in your neighborhood. So we are a community. So consequently, it's absolutely appropriate that we have communion together." The other thing that I think about when I think about fostering, and this leads to our time of communion, is that if you think about it, Fostering is perhaps, and maybe there's a better, but perhaps it's the perfect picture of the gospel. And I say that for three reasons. Paul wrote that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That when the world was still a mess, and before people in the world had ever decided to not be a mess, while the world was filled with sin, God sent his son into this world, right into the middle of our mess, to do for us what we could not do for ourselves. And he did for us what we could not do for ourselves, knowing that most of us would reject the offer. That all of our stories, even as Christians, would not turn out to be good stories. And he did it anyway. And that's foster care, isn't it? Secondly, because the gospel is a reflection of unconditional love. And you know, as a parent, it's easy for me to say that I love my kids unconditionally, but there's a win in that for me. You almost can't not love your children. Now, you can be pushed to the edge of not loving your children, but once you take a deep breath and the pain and the chaos and, you know, the doors are no longer slamming, at some point you kind of settle back in and you love your children. You love your children because they're your children. But you have to choose to love a foster child. And that is the gospel. And the third part is because it really is sacrificial love. With biological kids, there is usually some sort of payoff. With foster kids, there's a high probability that they will just take off and that one day they will be pulled out of your home. One day they will age out. And one day, as grateful as they should have been, they may never learn to express gratitude. And so it is with so many people that our Heavenly Father sent his son to die for. So there may be a better picture in some ministry context than foster care when it comes to a reflection and a parallel of the gospel, but I don't know of one. So it is absolutely appropriate because we're a community that we take communion together. But I think maybe equally as important because what you do really does reflect the essence of what we believe as Christians and who we worship as Christians. So if you would take the bread, and I just want to read this one famous verse of scripture as Jesus gathered with his disciples for what would be his final Passover, and what would essentially be for those men and women their final Passover, because the next time they would gather, they would not gather to remember what happened in the nation of Israel many, many years before. But the next time they gathered, they would remember what took place within a few hours of their final Passover with Jesus when he gave his life for them. Matthew 26 says this, "While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples, saying, 'Take and eat, this is my body.'" And then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood, the blood of a new covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sin." Father, thank you so much for that moment in each of our lives where we first recognized that there was a God who loved us and who had invited us to call him Father. Thank you for that moment in our lives when it occurred to us that our sin separated us from you, and that simply because you chose to love us, you chose to reconcile our relationship and gave us the opportunity to move in your direction. And many of us chose not to for a long time. Many of us chose to pursue you, and then at some season of our life, we walked away. And then when we decided to come back, we believe you took us back. And Father, that's what we want to be for our children, for our grandchildren, and that's what we want to be for these foster children. So would you please give us eyes to see all of this the way that you see it? Give us the courage to press through those difficult and dark nights and those difficult conversations, those disappointments that are many, And then to be able to latch on to those conversations that make us think that perhaps we're getting through. And Father, would you give us success in the way that we need success so that we don't give up? And again, open our eyes to see the significance of what you've done for us, and within that context, to understand the value of what we're doing for these children. And I pray that you would raise up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children through our foster care system and our churches. And I pray that you give us the ability to multiply it throughout our network of churches and all over our country. And that 30 something years from now, there will be lots of stories about men and women who grew up with a different picture of family and their Heavenly Father. In Jesus' name.